Christian state of life or sermons on the principal duties of Christians in general and of different states in particular by Father Francis Hunault, translated from the original German edition of Cologne, 1740, by Father J. Allen. Copyright 1889. On the course to be followed by young people, a state of life. Preached on the first Sunday of Advent. Preached on the first Sunday after Epiphany. Did you not know that I must be about my Father's business? St. Luke chapter 2, verse 49. This is the end and object for which all of us mortals are created. For this alone are we in the world, that we may be always about the business of our Heavenly Father, that we may serve God, love Him, do His will, and finally be eternally happy with Him. Christian children, I have lately shown you what your duty is to God with regard to that business, and proved that you must, especially in your youth, be pious and zealous in the service of your God. But you will not always remain children, and in the years of childhood, the time will come when you must make choice of a permanent state of life in which it will be the will and desire of God that you should serve Him during your lives. Do you think of that? It is a matter that you must early begin to reflect upon seriously and carefully, and certainly you require good advice in it. I will give you the best advice. It is with God alone that children and parents should often and carefully take counsel in the choice of a state of life, as I shall show in the first part. Many parents and children never think of consulting God in this matter, to the great detriment of both, as I shall prove in the second part. Young people wishing to enter on a state of life must follow God alone and His vocation. Such will be the subject of the first part. Grant us thy light and grace, O God, through the intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary and her holy guardian angels. A well-known proverb says that we must deliberate long over a matter, that we have only one chance of terminating successfully. No man of sense would think of entering on a weighty business on which much happiness or misery depends, blindly and without giving the matter due consideration and taking the advice of experienced men. Otherwise, he would expose himself to the risk of failure. For instance, a man has a large sum of money which he wishes to invest in some business. How he thinks and consults before he lets it go out of his hands, how such and such a person is situated, whether he will be able to pay the yearly interest, whether he has not borrowed money elsewhere, whether his property is unencumbered or mortgaged, whether the business that he carries on is a risky one or not, etc., etc. All these points and many other similar ones must be cleared up first of all, with the greatest care and exactness, so that a complete knowledge of the man and of his position may be had. And that is quite right, for there is question of a large sum of money that may be lost in that business. Even in matters of less importance, such as hiring a servant or a housemaid, many questions are asked about the person's fidelity and morality, and that is right, too, for it would be too late to deliberate afterwards once the agreement is made. If the person is proved not to suit them, the master must put up with the inconvenience till the end of the year. Therefore, we must deliberate for a long time over a matter that we have but one chance of bringing to a successful conclusion. What shall our son or our daughter be is a general question of parents. What state of life shall I enter on? Children sometimes ask themselves. Father, mother, children, do you know what depends on this question and what sort of a business is concerned in it? Is it about hiring a servant, investing money, gaining or losing property? Truly, if the world and its goods depended thereon, I need not lose my time exhorting you to mature deliberation, for such is beyond my line of duty. No, my dear brethren, a much greater and more important business, as we must acknowledge in our hearts, is concerned in this question. It is not enough for the daughter to find a rich husband in the married state, nor for the son to obtain a rich prebend for benefits in the ecclesiastical state. Nor is it enough for the son or daughter to enter a well-regulated and holy community in the religious state. All this will not be a satisfactory solution to the question. The question is about a state of life on the choice of which generally depends either heaven or hell for all eternity, the eternal happiness of those young people, or their eternal misery in everlasting fire. And how is that? Cannot God bring all men to heaven? Of course he can, and will do it too, if we only earnestly ask him to do so. Can we not save our souls in any state of life? Of course we can. But remember that not everyone can work out his salvation in any state, because, according to the unanimous teaching of the Holy Fathers, a certain state of life is a certain way in which divine providence, ordering all things in number, weight, and measure, leads a certain man to eternal salvation. And to this state, God gives for that man suitable helps and powerful graces, which would not be found in another state, and without which that man, although absolutely speaking, he could still, generally speaking, would not persevere in good and save his soul, or would do so only with difficulty. It is evident, then, that our salvation does not always depend on the holiness of the state we make choice of, but on the conformity of that state with the will of God and with the arrangements of his providence that he made for us for all eternity. Thousands of both sexes have saved their souls in the ecclesiastical state, but that boy or that girl would be eternally lost in it. Thousands of both sexes have lost their souls in the secular state, and yet that boy or that girl will gain heaven in it. There are thousands now in hell who, if they had embraced another state of life, would be in heaven. And there are thousands now in heaven who would have died miserably and lost their souls if they had not chosen the state appointed for them by God. Even at this moment, there are thousands leading bad lives who will die an unhappy death and be lost because they disregarded the divine will in embracing a state of life. Oh, the depth of the riches and the wisdom and of the knowledge of God, how incomprehensible are his judgments, and how unsearchable his ways, and at the same time, how just. Ah, my dear brethren, there is great need, then, of counsel and deliberation for parents and children when the question is asked, what shall my son or my daughter be? What state of life shall I embrace? What state has God called me to? In what state can I save my soul according to the decree of providence? Who will tell me this? Whom shall I ask about it? Whose advice shall I seek? Who can give me solitary counsel in such an important matter so that I can accept his decision? What sort of knowledge must such an advisor have, do you think? Oh, almost infinite knowledge and understanding. He must be able to penetrate into the divine council chamber so as to know what are the hidden decrees regarding me and the way of my salvation. He must know the order and variety of graces, one after the other, which are prepared for me my whole life long, at all times, in all places and circumstances. He must know if I shall correspond with those graces and in what degree. He must know all the temptations and snares that the devil, the world, and my own flesh will place in my way in the state of life he counsels me to choose. He must foresee all the occasions of good or evil that such a state will offer me, and many other things, too, must he know beforehand, so as to be aware of all the changes of time, age, prosperity, and adversity. He must be able to see into my heart and to know my inclinations and most secret desires. If he is wanting in any degree in this knowledge and experience, he cannot give me certain advice regarding the state of life in which I am to save my soul. But where in the world can I find such an advisor? If Solomon, that wonder of wisdom, came out of his grave, he could not help me. Father, mother, relation, no matter how much you love me and desire my salvation, this is too much for you. This you cannot do. Although my duty obliges me to obey you in all things with the greatest respect and filial love, yet in this matter I cannot trust to your word and your guidance alone. I do not even know myself thoroughly, as far as the inclinations and weaknesses of my soul are concerned. Much less can I know how it will be with me in the future, or what will happen to me in this or that state of life, so that, with regard to my choice of a state, it would be useless for me to have recourse to such advisors. It is God, my dear brethren, and God alone, who has all the necessary knowledge and who sees clearly what is good or bad for the soul of each one at all times and in all circumstances. It is also who uses his knowledge for the greater good of man when he calls him by his providence to a certain state of life. It is God, and God alone, who has prepared for each one a special grace called the grace of vocation, by which he will lead each one to the proper state of life. And if anyone enters a state of life without that grace, he recedes from the way of salvation and places himself in the way of eternal ruin. It is God, and God alone, who has reserved for himself the office of decreeing the state of life that each one must embrace, and he never allows anyone else to perform this office, even if anyone else were capable of doing so. St. Gregory assigns the cause of this. God, he says, is the best and most excellent Father of all men. Nay, he is the only one whom we can look upon as the Father of both body and soul, and he admits of no rival. When the heroic mother of the Maccabees saw her children undergoing the most cruel tortures at the hands of executioners, when she saw them flayed alive, cut in pieces and boiled, and yet bearing all this with the greatest patience and courage, "Ah," she said, "my dear children, lift up your eyes to heaven. I neither gave you breath, nor soul, nor life, neither did I frame the limbs of every one of you. But the creator of the world that formed the nativity of man and that found out the origin of all. I am your mother according to the flesh, but the best part of you, your soul, is a masterpiece from the hand of God, your heavenly Father. From this it follows, my dear brethren, that the Lord God alone has the right of directing the vocation of man according to his will and of prescribing to him a certain state of life. For it is in that dominion properly consists, as well as the fatherly care which he has for the soul, the spirit, and the will of man. An earthly father can and must look after the Christian education of his children. He must have a care of their support, nourishment, goods, and property. But in what concerns their own persons, that is, their free will and the choice of a state of life, no one but thou, O my God, can direct and ordain therein. And how comes it, asks St. Bernard, that each and every state of life, which constitutes the wonderful diversity of men in the world, receives the name of vocation? One is called to the worldly state, is a general expression, another to the religious, another to the military state, and so on. What is the meaning of that, if not that each one has a certain state appointed for him, to which he is called by God and by his all-wise decrees? Why did the Holy Fathers look upon it as such a great sin to select a state of life without being called to it by God? Certainly, because all states, with the sole exception of that appointed for us by God, are very dangerous and injurious to our salvation. And the man who is where he is not called by God is, so to speak, out of his proper place. I do not mean to say that it is a mortal sin not to follow the call of God, but I maintain, with the Holy Fathers, that it is placing oneself in great danger of future sin and so of eternal damnation. Amongst the other sad mishaps that the world has experienced in this particular, listen to the following later by Father Nicholas Flancisius, a man renowned for his writing as well as for his holy life. I had, he writes, in the Roman seminary, under my instruction, a lad endowed with the rarest natural gifts, who was a relation to a certain illustrious patriarch. After having, under my direction, made the exercises of our Holy Father Ignatius very devoutly, the young man asked me if it would be a sin not to follow the voice of God calling one to the religious state. On account of certain things that I was aware of, I answered him very cautiously that it might be done without any apparent grievous sin, since vocation is not a command, but rather a counsel on the part of God. Still, that it is certain that many are lost because they do not obey this call of God to the religious state, not precisely on account of losing their vocation, but on account of the many sins into which God foresaw that they would fall in the world, and to preserve them from which he wished to separate them from the world and to call them to the religious state. And such was indeed the case with that young man. For not long afterwards, he left the Roman college and went to Macerata to study law. Here he quickly forgot his former pious practices, as many young people do when they are left to themselves, away from their parents in foreign countries. He left off frequent confession and communion. Instead of visiting the churches, he spent his time with companions in his own stamp, in gaming and drinking houses, in places of readings spiritual books, He read impure romances, and amongst other sins which follow such an unrestrained mode of life, he nurtured an impure passion for an abandoned woman. As he was returning home one dark night from her house, he met a rival who was also attached to the same woman. The meeting took place in the public street opposite to the gate of the very convent to which he had received a vocation from God. The rival attacked the young man and stabbed him to the heart. The unfortunate youth, weltering in his blood, cried out with dying voice for his confessor. But before the latter could reach him, he breathed his last right before the gate of those religious amongst whom, according to divine decree, he should have found eternal happiness. Instead of that, he found eternal damnation and verified in himself the terrible sentence, "I called and you refused. You have despised all my counsel. I also will laugh in your destruction and will mock. When sudden calamity shall fall on you and destruction as a tempest shall be at hand, then shall they call upon me, and I will not hear, because they did not consent to my counsel." Many such sad examples may be read in the annals of our society of those who refused to obey a call to the religious state. All this forces me to the necessary conclusion of the first part. If all states in the world come from divine vocation, if every state is not good for the salvation of everyone, if no one in the world can know or teach me what state is the safest for me, if no man has the right or the power to compel me to embrace a state according to his will, if God alone knows which is the best for my salvation, if God alone will and must direct me there herein, if it is dangerous not to follow the call of God, and meanwhile salvation or damnation depends on the choice of a state, then it follows of necessity that it is God and God alone whom parents must often and earnestly ask, "O Lord, what dost thou will my child to be?" He is in thy hands, under thy guidance. Thou alone art the father of his soul. Leave the disposal of him to thee. Lead and guide him to that state in which thou wishest him to serve thee. The necessary consequence, too, is that it is God and God alone from whom children especially must ask counsel, and for a long time, by frequent, earnest, and zealous prayer, and prepared for everything, they must cry out with the apostle, "Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? Give to my understanding that light thou hast promised to those who ask it of thee, so that I may know how and where I am to live according to thy vocation and holy will." Oh, if all children acted thus with regard to their state of life, if all parents left their children to be thus disposed of by God, what a heavenly life would each one lead on earth in the state appointed for him by God. How many souls would then go to heaven? But alas, it is God who is least of all asked for counsel in this matter, although it is of the greatest importance, and even when he makes known his will inwardly, he is the last of all to be listened to or obeyed either by parents or children. Therefore, it is no wonder that all are not in the state to which God called them, and consequently, that they are not as they would wish to be at the hour of death. No wonder is it that parents make such a gross mistake with their children and often ruin them forever. as we shall see in the second part. Our father, Mausanias, in his symbols, paints a ship without spread sails, ready to leave the shore, but without any fixed direction, with this motto: she is waiting for the wind. As soon as the wind comes, the ship goes away. If the wind is from the west, she goes to the east. If it comes from the east, she goes to the west. If it comes from the south, she goes to the north. If from the north, she goes to the south. She waits for the wind. It is no matter whence the wind comes or whether it blows. It is the same manner, my dear brethren, it seems to me, that many children act. When the time comes for them to choose a state of life, they are like ships with their sails set. They let themselves be driven in any direction, wherever the wind wills. They think not, reflect not. The first opportunity that offers seems good and acceptable to them. It is a vocation for them. Their voyage may be to the east or to the west. Their state may be either religious or worldly. It may lead their souls to heaven or to hell. They wait for the wind. Some an evening or other, in pleasant company, a young woman attracts the attention of one, a young man, that of another. Acquaintance is made, and attachment begins. Each party hopes that love is mutual. There is a favorable wind. Let the ship go. I know what I will do. I will get married. Here is one who wishes to resign a benefice in favor of a person who never thought of such a thing, or to produce a benefice for that person. What a favorable wind. The determination is made at once. No time is lost. The necessary orders are received. I will be a secular priest. There is a rich parish vacant, thinks another to himself. Can I get votes enough to apply for it? Yes, the majority are good friends of mine. See what a fair wind is blowing? Let there be no delay. I will apply at once. I will become a parish priest. Here a lucrative position is vacant. Oh, what a fair wind! I shall do my best to obtain it. But he who fills that office must be unmarried. No matter, I accept the condition. Thus any moment made, choice is made, the resolution fixed in a matter on which the whole of one's afterlife, as well as eternity, depends. With reason does Seneca say, you may see many wandering about in uncertainty, who do not know what they had intended, but what occurred to them by chance. Whether that marriage so blindly contracted, that chance position in the church, that parish so luckily obtained, or that office with the condition of celibacy attached, will have a good or bad effect on the soul's salvation, or will give good opportunities for saving one's soul. That question is never even dreamt of, much less is it maturely considered during waking moments, until the time comes when the state is chosen for life and reflection is too late. There are others who wish to act more prudently. They think and reflect for a long time beforehand and very carefully on the state of life they shall choose. But not with him whom they should consult first of all. Such people seem to me like the sailors of the eastern islands, who, not knowing anything of the magnetic needle, and yet wishing to cross the sea, took a certain kind of bird with them. And when they wished to return, let the bird go, and since it had a natural instinct to go back to its own country, that followed in the direction of its flight. But how unreasonably men act who allow themselves to be guided by unreasoning animals. Birds can show where land is, but they cannot point out where the safe harbors and secure passages are to be found. Therefore, it generally happened that the unlucky ship was driven on the rocks and broken in pieces. Not otherwise, I say, did those children enter on the voyage of life, as far as the choice of a state is concerned. They allow themselves to be advised and led by untamed, unreasoning birds, that is to say, either by their bad inclinations and sensuality, or by men who, as I said before, do not and cannot know what is good or bad for their soul's salvation. In that state, I can live most comfortably, and then either I can get on better in the world, and this I can have more pleasures, with that person I shall get great riches, and so on, and that is all they think of. They ask, what shall I be? But whom do they ask? Their parents, whose will and pleasure alone they want to know, or their relations or companions, whose advice and example they wish to follow? They leave the magnetic needle, which alone can lead them safely. They never consult God, who alone knows the state of life suited to them, nor ask Him for counsel. And what a miserable shipwreck will be the result. What useless repentance and profitless complaints will be sure to follow. What an unhappy, discontented, and wicked life, and what a miserable death must be the result. And even if none of these consequences followed, how can there be any peace of conscience in a state in which one does not know whether he is doing the will of God or not? In a life which was begun without God, in which, for all one knows, may still be without Him, inasmuch as we cannot know if it is regulated according to His pleasure. Still, it seems easier to excuse young people in this matter on account of their want of experience. But should not the parents at least supply what is wanting to their children by their care and instruction? Should they not often exhort and compel them to have recourse to God and to pray earnestly for light in such an important matter and show them how to pray? But, unfortunately, they are often wanting in this duty and this parental obligation so strictly enforced by God. Not only do they fail to exhort their children to recommend the matter to God, but they take the selection of a state for their children to their own hands, without taking any account of God. What do you think, or rather, as it is said in reality, what do you wish your son or our daughter to be? Such is a question put to the wife by the husband, and to the husband by the wife. Yes, they say, it will be a difficult matter to bring them up according to our condition. Our eldest son, as a matter of course, must remain in the world. The other, who is a little stupid and awkward, will do for the church. And we can look out for the benefits for him. We need not be uneasy about our youngest daughter. She will have suitors enough. The eldest looks rather plain. She will do for the convent. And so they settle the whole affair, and the poor children, thus predestined by their parents before they are grown up and able to judge for themselves, have to agree and to enter in the state pointed out for them by their father or mother, whether they like it or not. Whether it is good or bad for them, whether it is their vocation or not. Now, if the children have no liking for that state, and if the parents are unwilling actually to force them to accept it, as I believe is the case with most Christian parents, still the matter can be so managed that your children must pretend to have a liking for it and to choose it freely. For those who are to remain in the world are allowed great liberty and are brought up to vanity. They are allowed to go into society and company, and with their tender minds, like young plants, are easily bent and biased at pleasure, so that they become quite worldly. Nothing is spoken of in their presence but marriage. If they show the least sign of having an inclination to any religious life, they are at once sent off somewhere, or are kept occupied with all sorts of things that can be of no use to them except in the world. And what is still more unchristian, temptations and snares are placed in their way. They are brought into dangerous occasions. They are sent to countries from which, as experience teaches, they will bring back nothing but vanity, frivolity, sin, and vice, so that the religious feelings must soon be dulled in them. They are kept away from sermons that they may not hear anything good, and thus become more pious and more inclined to the religious life. In fact, my dear brethren, I know not what to think. It seems to me that an answer that was once given to the preacher of my acquaintance must be true. The preacher was complaining to a person that, after having preached on the duties of children for such a long time, they still seemed to have profited but little. "Oh," said the other, "you must not wonder at that, Father. Parents are afraid that their children will become pious, and therefore they keep them from coming to the sermons, although the children would come readily enough if left to themselves." God grant that this may not be the case amongst us. The other children, whom their parents have predestined to the religious life, are treated in a totally different manner. They are kept in solitude at home, so as to hear and see nothing of what passes in the world. They are brought to convents and churches. Pious books and pictures are placed in their way. They are continually told of the happiness and contentment of the religious state. And that is really true, as all experience who are called by God to that state. Oh, would to God that all parents brought up their children in that way, but with pure and better motive, and after having first taken counsel from God, and leaving their children their own choice and free will to follow the divine call, whatever it may be. In one word, the son or daughter is sometimes flattered, sometimes threatened, until consent is obtained. And if they refuse at first, the parent shows such displeasure and dissatisfaction that at last the innocent children, are moved by a sense of shame and filial love to bow down beneath the yoke which is placed on their shoulders, not by the will of God, but by the will of their father and mother, who take no account of God in the matter at all. For, they say, if the vocation is not there yet, it must come by and by. No, says Salvianus, with bitter irony, we are not living in the days of Abraham, when the sacrifice of children by the hands of their parents was a rare and prodigious event. Nothing is commoner in the world in our days than for parents to imitate Abraham. They joyfully sacrifice their children to God. They do not even wait for a command from on high to do so. They do it before God requires it of them. They sacrifice their children, although he has not asked for such a sacrifice and will not accept it. But I am wrong, after all, continues Salvianus. These parents are not at all like Abraham. For that holy man was ready to immolate his son because God told him to do so. They, on the contrary, sacrificed their children to God, not according to his counsel, nor for his service, but they forced them on him, so to speak, with violence, in order to satisfy their own avarice or evil inclination, and for some other temporal motive. Abraham received exceeding great praise and an eternal reward for his ready obedience. But you, O parents, what kind of reward do you expect for the sacrifice you offer through self-will? What kind of reward do you expect from God, whose office you thus handsomely usurp? If I be a father, where is my honor? Such is his just complaint to the prophet Malachi. If I am the supreme father of all souls, where are the honor and respect that are due to me? Where is the sign of my paternal authority? If their fathers and mothers try to take it away from me, if I have nothing more to do with those whom I have created, if I cannot appoint for them the state of life which I wish them to enter. O mortals, can you dare to be guilty of such injustice? Who has given you authority and power to do so? I have given you your children in trust. I have lent them to you, that you may keep them according to my will and bring them up. But you constitute yourselves lords and masters over them. You actually turn their free will according to your own plans. Thus I am a father only in name, while you have all the power. It is in vain that you protest sometimes that your children belong more to me than to yourselves. If such were really the case, you should leave it to me to select the state of life for them. As the idea takes you, you order one into my service in the religious state, and you keep the other for the world. Who told you that I want the one and not the other? Must I then take what you do not wish to have? The vocation to a particular state is a grace. Who has given you power to distribute it according to your own will? I alone can and will give that grace to whom and when I will. The eternal happiness of your children generally depends on that grace. Where did you get knowledge enough to foresee that state would be best for their souls? This foreknowledge I have reserved to myself. And what sort of thanks do you expect from your children if the state you force them into should cause the loss of their souls? If your son leads an impious life in the religious state or an unchristian life in the world, or if your daughter leads a life of discontent and anxiety and despair in the convent like a poor soul in purgatory, how bitterly they will cry out to me for vengeance on you, and how they will complain that they have been brought to eternal death by those from whom they received life, and who should have brought them to eternal life. You know, too, that I will require those souls which you have stolen from me at your hands. Christian parents, take this to heart. Leave to their Creator alone the selection of a state for your children. I do not mean that you should give yourselves no trouble about it. That would be indeed a great mistake, and those who are careless in what becomes of their children must answer for the neglect if they allow the latter to choose the first state that comes into their heads. No, it is your duty to help your children with advice and exhortation, and to assist them to the best of your ability to enter on the state to which God has called them. Your duty is, if your child wishes to undertake anything rashly, to restrain him until he has thought the matter over. Your duty is, if your child chooses a state in which there are evident dangers of evil, or if his motives are not good, or if he wishes to enter on it by unlawful means, to use your parental authority and to prevent him, even against his will. The whole lesson that you have to learn from today's sermon is this. You must not determine on a state of life for your children without first deliberating maturely and taking counsel with God, and you must frequently exhort your children to do the same. And you, O children, to whom your vocation is of the greatest importance, remember the advice of the wise Sirach. Pray to the Most High that he may direct thy way in truth. Think and think often. What shall I be, a saint in heaven or a demon in hell? Oh, certainly, I ought not to hesitate. I must and will save my soul, no matter how the world may go with me. I will go to heaven. Even if I must leave my parents, I will go to heaven. Even if I must sacrifice all my goods and pleasures, I will go to heaven. I can do without my parents and friends for all eternity, but I cannot do without heaven. I can live poor and without sensual joys, but I cannot burn in hell forever. I am resolved and firmly, I will go to heaven. Therefore, I must not choose a state of life in order to grow rich, nor to enjoy life, but to go to heaven. Therefore, I must and will choose that state which will most surely lead me to heaven. And what state is that? No other than that to which God calls me. Therefore, I must and will obey the voice of God, and that he may show me what my vocation is, I will pray daily, especially in the Holy Mass and the Holy Communion. When I have my God within me, and with humility and childlike confidence, O Lord, thou enlightenest all men that come into the world. Thou hast said with thine own infallible word, ask, and ye shall receive. Behold, O Lord, I earnestly beg of thee something that nearly concerns thy honor and my salvation, which I cannot know without thy inspiration. Show me the state of life in which thou wishest me to serve thee. To that end, I will pray every day to the Blessed Mother of God and to my holy angel guardian. I will select a confessor to whom I will open my heart and whose advice I will follow, as that of one whom God makes use of to declare his will to me. And when I shall at last have, in my future state of life, the consolation, whoever it may be with me, well or ill, that I did not choose it for myself, nor through the inspirations of flesh and blood, but with the divine counsel and according to the divine will. Then I shall be certain that God will assist me with special helps and graces in all dangers, temptations, difficulties, and anxieties of my state of life. And such is the case, Christian souls. You will then be in that ship which has Jesus Christ as its pilot, and he will guide you to heaven, to the haven of eternal happiness. Amen.